So good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rhys. That was a video made by the IET. I'm here wearing a number of hats this afternoon. They're those hats mainly. So I work for Airbus Group. I'm an engineer. I develop lightning strike protection for our new aircraft. So I have what I think is quite a cool job in engineering. We get to blow stuff up with lightning in a lightning lab with a big red button and everything. But I'm also a member of the IET, and a lot of people ask me, why do I volunteer for the IET? In fact, why do I even pay my membership for the IET? And there's actually a whole load of things I get out of the IET, which I'm not going to talk about today. But if the only thing I got out of the IET from my membership over the lifetime I'm probably going to be a member was that video, then I think my membership fees would actually be worth it. I think it's the most powerful video that I've seen that gives that message that we need more engineers and we need to get the message right to young minds in order to make sure that we have enough engineers going forward. So I'm just going to talk to you today a little bit about some research that the IET has done that sparked that video in the first place, and also talk to you a little bit about some of the things I've done in this area, maybe provoke a few ideas that might stimulate you to go and do something similar, and also come up with your own ideas. So I said I wear a number of hats. My real job is the one in the middle there, working for Airbus Group. I'm also a radio presenter at Radio Cardiff. I present a bunch of shows, one of which is a science and technology magazine programme. I'm a STEM ambassador, which is how I got into a lot of outreach work. And I am one of the founders of Cardiff Science Festival as well, which is entirely run by volunteers and is about to go into its fourth year. So, the more astute amongst you might have noticed, by the way, that my name is Rhys and my job is involved in lightning, and there's a particular nickname of Rhys Lightning, which didn't take people long to come up with. The research. So this research was conducted by the IET last year. They spoke to children between the ages of 9 and 12. This is the age that's commonly recognised where we need to be targeting. We need to get the idea of what engineering is and how exciting STEM science, STEM subjects can be in general. So this was sort of the motivation for the research. We basically need more engineers, but children and parents are discouraged from going into engineering. So we need to speak to the children, but the issue is that even if we tell the children, if we can inspire them in school, if they then go home where they spend most of their time with their parents and their parents don't think it's a good career for them, then all of that hard work has gone to waste. So a couple of the key points that came out of the research. These are the words that children used during this survey to describe what they thought about science subjects in general in school. So at this point, engineering is not mentioned. This is asking them to talk about what they like about science, maths, IT and DT in school. And actually, it's pretty positive. We find that children of that age, they do like these subjects. So the issue is not that they don't like science, they don't like technology or maths. So what is the problem then? Well, then we ask them to come up with words when they think about engineering. Now, not all of these are hugely negative. Some of there's things in there about taking things apart, learning exciting things, problem solving. But there's very little in there about being creative. There's lots about putting things together. There's also a lot about fixing things, but not about being creative. And unfortunately, this is a problem that we have in the UK, and pretty much only in the UK. You hear the word engineering, and a lot of people think of the word engine. This problem doesn't happen in most of Western Europe. The excuse that people come up with for the UK is that, well, in Western Europe, they can hear the original stem of the word, which was ingenious, engineer, and so they realise that it's someone who's using science and applying it to the real world. And in English, we have the word engine. But unfortunately, it still only applies to the UK and not other English-speaking nations. So something has gone wrong just here in the UK. We're not quite sure why this has happened, other than the fact that engineer is not a protected word. So in the US and Canada, particularly in Canada, you have to have an engineering qualification to be allowed to call yourself an engineer. Here in the UK, if you fix boilers, you can put boiler engineer onto the side of your van and no one can stop you from doing that. So we've got some work to do in making sure that what engineering really is disseminated to children, to the next generation of engineers, and also to our the parents and teachers who they're going to be engaging with. The other issue is the lack of women in engineering, and this is an interesting one because the question that was asked to parents was, Do you think engineering as a career is more appropriate for your sons or your daughters? And nearly half of them, well, no, exactly half of them say that it's more appropriate for their sons. So this is not a stereotype that the kids are picking up from their peers. This is coming from the parents, which is clearly not a healthy situation to be in. So this is the other problem we've got to deal with. We've also got to find some way of being able to engage more girls into engineering. And it's recognised that girls learn in different ways, and that means that probably some development will be needed in how these sorts of things are taught in the classroom, and some sort of initiatives which are purely aimed at girls will be needed. And they already are existing and starting to do this work. So the main conclusions from the research that the IIT conducted last year were that we need to raise the profile of engineering in general. We need to communicate the breadth of it so that they realise that there's a whole load of interesting jobs and careers out there in engineering that they probably didn't realise were part of engineering. We've got the issue that we need to prevent girls from being disengaged with these subjects, and also the parents. So I just want to talk to you then a little bit about some of the stuff that I've done. And one of the big things that I do is going into schools. This is sort of the starting point for a lot of people working in this area. And there's some things, if any of you haven't yet gone into a school to talk about what you do in your jobs, I encourage you to do so, but I encourage you to take a few things on board before you do so. The first is never underestimate what young children know. I quite often start a talk by asking people to tell me what lightning is. Now, in a room like this, I suspect I'll get a fairly thorough answer about what lightning is. There's probably someone in here who can answer it better than I can. In a secondary school, I was used to getting some information about clouds and charge and electricity. I went into a primary school for the first time. Well, not the first time. I was at a primary school when I was young, but you know what I mean. I was assuming that I'd get a dumbed down answer. I was expecting someone to say something like a flash of light in the sky, maybe a mention of electricity, maybe someone bring up thunder. What I got was a six-year-old boy, who put his hand up, and when I say put his hand up, he was sort of trying to touch the sky, pick me. So I asked him if he could tell me what lightning is, and he said, well, is it when charge separates in the cloud, and as the charge separates and it moves around the cloud, you get an electric field building up. And as the electric field builds up, it starts to ionise the air. And as the air becomes more ionised, it becomes conductive, and you get a conductive path from the cloud down to the ground. And eventually that electric current can transfer from the cloud to the ground, and that's what we call a lightning strike. And I went, yep. Pretty much it. I asked him if he wanted to do the rest of my talk for me. He didn't. He cried. I'm not allowed back there anymore. But anyway. The key thing here is not to underestimate what children know. It turns out that this particular student, A, had a dad who was in the RAF, so was interested in planes, and B, had watched a documentary about lightning on YouTube over and over again and basically knew it word for word because he found it interesting. And so in this day and age where media like that is very widely available, it's very easy for children to be able to do that. And it's a great thing, but it can catch you out. The second thing is you have to make it engaging. Now, you can't go into, especially a primary school. Now, my job title is actually Research Engineer in Electrostatics. Now, if I go in and tell a primary school kid that that's my job title, it's going to mean nothing to them. If I go in and tell them I'm a scientist who protects planes from lightning strikes, that gets their interest straight away. Dull slides of bullet points also don't work, and videos do work. And I'm going to play you a video now. I want you all to pretend, in fact, that you are a bunch of primary school kids. I'm going to play you a video. I'm going to pause it. I want you to tell me what you think happens next. Your primary school children. What happens next?
Explodes.
It explodes. Any other answers?
Unicorn.
I admit that's the first time I've had that answer. We had... Okay, I knew this was a bad idea. I had one audience in Cardiff where someone shouted out nothing and someone else shouted out something, which did mean they covered all bases. Now, and my favourite answer actually was in the primary school where, the same primary school where a little girl asked me if the lightning recharged the plane's batteries, which I think is the cutest answer I've heard, but it's also a very logical answer as well. So I'm going to play the video just to humour you. I know you all know. It would be very morbid if I was going to show you a plane that exploded now, wouldn't it? So yes, it does keep on flying, of course. But playing a video like this to demonstrate the point and then getting the audience or the children to try and work out what's happening and then talking through why it happens is a much more engaging way. Then they'll remember it. If I come in and start talking about Faraday cages and electricity and metals conducting straight away, they're going to switch off almost immediately. If I start by showing them a video where a plane gets struck by lightning, then they're going to remember that. And the same, I've got one other video which I want to play as an example. We have a lightning laboratory. Now, it sounds very cool. We really do put bits of plane in, we zap it, we press a big red button, things explode, we try and see what works and what doesn't work in terms of lightning strike protection. But in reality, what you see in there is not particularly exciting. There's a piece of material, a lightning bolt comes down and some material comes off. It doesn't make the greatest video in the world. But if you put other things in the lightning laboratory, they make more interesting videos. And there was a couple of years ago where we'd had a Children in Need raffle in work, which I'd won. Unfortunately, I'd won a prize that I had no use for, no desire to keep. So just purely for your interest and as a demonstration of something I tend to show audiences when I'm doing talks, this is what happens when you put a piggy bank in a lightning laboratory. It's in slow motion, by the way. I think that's quite cool, and kids tend to love that and remember that. So, that's audiences of schools and children, but we've got a job to do in engaging the general public as well. Parents, but the general public as a whole, we need to try and change this image of engineering. There was a survey done by the Royal Academy of Engineering a few years ago which asked members of the public to name a famous engineer, and you can understand that maybe there's a lot of engineers that the general public won't have heard of, but I assume that someone like Brunel may have come out top. Unfortunately, it was some car mechanic off Coronation Street that came top of the survey. And a similar survey was done about scientists, and it was the scientists off the Muppets that came out on top, although I kind of don't mind that one so much. So, because at least they're scientists. So we've got this job to do with public audiences as well, and there's a few things that I do here, but there's different challenges that you have to overcome. So I mentioned the radio show. I present a weekly science radio show. There are two audiences to a science radio show. There's an audience who've got the radio on in the car and they've had it on and they're driving around, or they've had it on to listen to something else and they're doing the dishes so they can't turn it off, and therefore they're kind of forced to listen to you and you don't want them to switch off. But they've probably not tuned in especially for science. But then we've also got an audience who are going online, downloading a podcast every week because they're particularly interested in the subject matter. And it's actually quite tricky to be able to meet the demands of both those audiences without alienating one or the other. So that's one of the challenges that we have with a science radio show. And similarly with a science festival or a talk at a science festival, you've got a mixed audience usually. In fact, well, even in this room, I don't know what the backgrounds of everyone in this room are. I don't know how many of you have got some background in physics and therefore know what I'm talking about with, say, a Faraday cage. I'm assuming most of you do, but I'm probably wrong. And so if I was doing a talk about lightning and Faraday cages right now, I would do it very differently. So there are these extra problems that we need to deal with audiences, public audiences as well. And the final point I wanted to make before I leave you with one other video is coming back to women in science and engineering. We've kind of got a duty to give a false impression, or at least this is the way that I look at it, is that we've got a duty to give a false impression about the number of women in engineering to the public, and particularly to school children. The reality is that 13% of the STEM workforce in the UK are women. Now, if you have a panel discussion, and only 13% of the people who get to take part in science panel discussions were women, then the impression that we give is that only 13, that it's predominantly male, and that it's never going to change unless we start making sure that we give a picture of a more balanced gender split. The argument against it, of course, is that then you might have some people who feel that they're being asked onto the panel because they're a woman, and that's the only reason. So there's a difficulty there, and it's a challenge that anyone who's organising events where they're trying to engage the general public with science has to address, and I don't think there's a perfect solution. Personally, I think we have to go down the route of forcing this fake impression in order to make people realise that that's what it should be. I'm going to leave you with a video. A project I've been involved with for the last few years has opened my eyes to a new way of looking at science communication and passing the messages on, because the aims and objectives of it were not purely to inspire science. I was asked to do something where there were two aims. One was to inspire science, one was to get French children to use their English skills. And I was asked to provide 3-hour workshops. And I now do this once or twice a year. I go to France for a week with the British Council with a project that's called Science in Schools, and I run 3-hour workshops where the first hour is me doing a show about my research and about electricity, and the second and third hours are a hands-on workshop. Now, that makes you really think about what you're doing, so there's a benefit for me. Also, it's another way of getting the message out there by piggybacking onto these other means. Okay, sorry.
I'm not going to have time for questions of yours.
Oh, that could work in my favour. And so what I did was I took my sort of secondary job as a radio presenter, and I get these children to, once they've learned the science, to make radio shows in English about the work. And I just want to leave you with a video that we made with the British Council for Science in Schools, just so you can get an idea of how it worked. Now, in the video, the film crew decided that radio interviews wouldn't be visual enough, so they do TV interviews on this one, but in reality we do radio interviews. And so what we've done this morning is I've presented about the research that I do at Airbus Roof, looking at lightning strikes hitting aircraft, how we protect against that. And I've introduced a task which will help them not only enforce the science that they've learned this morning, but also help them use their English skills. So they are creating a radio news bulletin. They have to script the bulletin, and then we're going to record them on microphones, reading their news bulletins out.
Mais il faut dire, oui, mais avant, il faut dire que tout le monde va bien. I'm a lightning chaser, and I want to take beautiful photo of lightnings in the sky. It's a fantastic job.
This practical exercise is a fun way to strengthen language skills.
Welcome everybody, it's Diana on TV Radio. We just received a special information from Vision. A plane has been struck by lightning.
Hello, it was very frightening. In fact, I was quietly listening to music and suddenly I saw a bright light through my window.
Hi, I represent the Airbus company. You don't have to be scared. There is any problem with our plans.
You have to know that the light which hit the plane was over 30,000 degrees, more than the sun's temperature. But all our planes are studied to resist to the storm.
Okay, back to the studio.
Thank you for listening. If you want to have further information, you can go on her website.
I'm going to mute that when we take questions, ooh, because just because it's probably a couple of minutes.
I guess we can do the easy kind of lightning fast questions. So.
So, hi, I did, one second, got rid of my notes, Rhys.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, I would like my notes. So, I'm Michelle Brook. I work at the Democratic Society, where I lead on a number of issues around science and technology and data and where they intersect with policy and democracy. I also run what is called DemSoc Cambridge, which is a local branch. Thank you. Which is a local branch of the Democratic Society, which is specific to Cambridge. And so if you like, you know, like any of those topics of conversation, or you just want to talk about politics and democracy and you live in Cambridge, do come and join us on Monday evening at 7 o'clock in the Maypole, where we'll be having drinks, as I said, from 7 onwards. So let's pretend you never saw my day job, because I'm not necessarily here representing the views of the organisation I work for, but instead kind of my broader ideas and aims around this kind of area. So Sam Smith asked me to talk about science and democracy, and it's a really interesting topic, and it's also incredibly difficult to cover, because if nothing else, definitions of both words are actually really strongly contested. Nobody really knows what science is, They know certainly what gets included: chemistry, physics, biochemistry. They know that kittens definitely aren't science, although there may be some research around kittens that takes place. But when it comes to issues around psychology or social science, there's a lot of kind of discussion and disagreement, and kind of there's a hell of a lot of tension that goes on in different spaces about kind of whether or not they should be included. As for me, in this talk, it doesn't really matter. I'm thinking far more about knowledge and research and how we can learn more about the world around us. Democracy, however, is possibly even more difficult to define as a word. It's loaded with all sorts of political, moral and social agenda when people think about it as a word. And because there are more people directly affected, or at least feel they're directly affected, they tend to get a lot more upset about misunderstandings. For instance, one person's idea of democracy is a first-past-the-post election that results in a representative figure, such as an MP or local councillor, who can make decisions on their behalf. And this takes place every 5 years, and that's a democratic process, and democracy is fulfilled. Big tick. For other people, and I imagine it's kind of the same for a lot of people in this room, they have kind of more leanings towards a more participatory process, where a more engaged citizenry can kind of get involved and actually have an effect on kind of the decisions that are made. For me, I personally lean towards that kind of model far more, but again, in this talk, it doesn't necessarily matter so much. I'm thinking far more about those ideas of politics and power and how a citizen's voice can necessarily be heard. And, you know, we can chat about representative models necessarily after the talk, if you so desire. I get excited by democracy. I'm sorry. This talk is not about science in democracy, because there's a Democracy Club talk taking place at the same time. It was the talk I was tempted to do, so talking about policy-making processes and expertise and involvement of science and social science research and the tools and culture changes needed. Again, if you want to chat about that, come and find me afterwards in the bar. Buy me a gin, and I'll talk about this for a long time. So instead, science and democracy. It's a little bit different as an idea to think about, so thinking about where the two overlap a lot more. So far as anybody really thinks about science, it's kind of a mystery. And when I say people, I mean normal people. People not like me, or kind of a bunch of people in this room, but people outside of academia. So this kind of black box here is representing university or industry, somewhere where science, whatever it is, takes place. So kind of what goes in, you get money going in, and people going in, and ideas going in, kind of alongside people. Then stuff happens in this magical black box, and out at the other end comes science, whatever that is. So you get a huge lack of knowledge about kind of these processes, what's going on, and this means there's no real ability for a citizen or a member of the public to really meaningfully engage, to take part, or to hold the processes really to account. A key question, I suppose, is kind of why should anyone really care about kind of people and general publics engaging in science? There's a couple of reasons. First off, science is part of our culture. It frames the country that we live in. It frames the work that our universities are doing. And bear in mind, these are institutions embedded in our local areas. It also kind of frames the kind of work that members of the public, such as us, can take part in. It frames what we read in the newspapers, what we see everywhere. And this, I think, is a great thing. But it does mean that there are problems if there's a deficit in terms of the knowledge base there. Secondly, I think that it's important for people to be able to hold science to account because it's taxpayer-funded. A lot of research in the UK is funded by the state, either directly, taking part in universities, or indirectly. I mean, even industry is in receipt of state subsidies in terms of tax breaks and kind of, you know, the use of highly trained staff that have been employed from the higher education sector. And also, because it's state subsidised, I think that it's really important that science shares its benefits with us and that people who engage in science share those benefits with us. And finally, I'd say science is awesome. I'm no longer a scientist, so I can also say that science is hell, it's difficult, it's repetitive, it's mundane. But it's also really interesting. And it's we shouldn't be excluding people from what is a really rewarding and valuable pastime, especially one which, as I said, is quite so heavily state subsidised. So if we take this as a rough model of kind of science, each of these four blocks have kind of problems with regarding science and democracy. But I'm not going to deal with the people aspect. That's a whole other issue, talking about the structural inequalities within higher education and science. But instead, I'm going to focus much more on the money, the kind of big black box, and science at the other end. So money. Where does science actually get its money from? So it has a lot of different sources of income, depending on whether or not it's taking place within universities or within industry. So, for instance, charities such as Wellcome Trust, big charity, and smaller charities such as Macmillan, all fund research that is taking place within the UK. They fund big buildings or they fund fellowships and different research programmes. Learned societies like the Royal Society also fund fellowships, and so they're having this direct influence on what science is taking place in the country. And then industry, which is an interesting one. They fund huge amounts of work within their own private laboratories, which is fair enough. They also take part in a lot of private-public partnerships. So they work very closely with universities, and this often takes place in or around a university base. And this is fine that you've got these three here, but it's very difficult to hold these to account because they're not in any way directly state-linked. But at the same time, it's important to remember that they're having a huge impact upon the framing of science and what science is taking place around us. I'm going to leave the EU out of it because as soon as you start talking about the EU, you start getting into conversations as to whether or not we should be a member, blah, blah, blah. However, I'm going to just touch far more on the bottom three here. These are all kind of accountable organisations. They're linked to government departments and they're very much organisations which are pulling in research or asking for people to take part in research. And it's the research councils and the higher education funding councils which share out the bulk of research money in the UK. So just to give you an idea, just one of the higher education funding councils in the UK in 2015 and 2016 will have a budget of about 1.6 billion. Whereas the research councils in the same time frame will have a budget of about 3 billion. Now it's this research councils that do science, they give the money out largely in a kind of go do good science kind of way, through kind of grants, research, studentships, and also through funding capital buildings that exist around. And that's all well and good, but it's done largely on the basis of expertise. Money is allocated on the basis of expertise as defined by academics, but also on the basis of stakeholder engagement. Now, this stakeholder engagement process often involves very large lobbying and strong voices being made, representations being made from the charities, industry and learned societies. So not only are they having a huge impact upon how what science is taking place within the country through their own funding, but also through their effect of lobbying on the other organisations, which are then funding science. And there's no real ability for citizens to push back and to question what science is taking place. The degree of this kind of varies across research council, but it's fair to say that there's going to be very little effect of the individual versus the effect of these large organisations. And who decides what science is taking place will really affect for whom science is taking place. I mean, I personally don't buy that industry is necessarily going to be driving science for a wider societal benefit. I get that, you know, economic benefit, which is their main aim, is going to have some overlap in some instances with wider societal benefit, but I don't think that that's necessarily, you know, always the case. And so when they're pushing for certain types of research to take place in the country, there's very much a problem in terms of that that may not be what we as a people necessarily want. And charities as well, I'm going to give them more of a benefit of a doubt because they've at least got to match charitable objectives. But again, what they're pushing for might not be what we as citizens necessarily would like to see taking place. And senior academics, again, they're human. They've got, you know, their own things that they're trying to push when they're trying to make decisions about what research should necessarily be funded. Don't get me wrong, some of my best friends are academics. But at the same time, it would be good to find ways that we can actually feed back more effectively into these kind of conversations. I would personally like to see some way and some mechanisms that allow the general population to feed back into kind of, you know, even a subsection of which grants can actually be funded by research councils. Find some way of actually having a meaningful conversation about what research should necessarily take place. And I think that there are some interesting possibilities there for tools and online platforms and offline platforms to really get to grips with this, and not just the traditional dialogue model that we've often seen, which is more of a haptic often than necessarily actually engaging in the process. So I'm just going to touch very briefly, because I'm aware of time, on some of the other issues. First off, I'd like to see us open up this box of the university. At the moment, it's somewhat of a black box. But public institutions should be held accountable. They're largely publicly funded, and this should require, in some way, some degree of openness. I totally accept that there are kind of, you know, issues around competition. Universities are running competition with one another, and you even get them now not being happy sharing of how they spend their students' tuition fees. So you get news headlines like this earlier this year. It's a really interesting question, how transparent or how open a university should be about its funding, about its partners, and about the research that's necessarily taking place. There's, on one side, I can very much see that there are people who are very happy with the status quo, and these tend to be entrenched interests. On the other hand, I can see some people being very keen to try and push almost total transparency. Personally, I'm not on either extreme. I'd like to see some transparency, more than we've got, and I would be really keen to actually have a conversation about how comfortable we are with the fact that we are effectively, in many cases, giving private companies some degree of public subsidy to perhaps carry out interesting research into surveillance or military in our very midst. I'm just going to touch briefly here on this. I'm really happy to see over the last couple of years, as Joe MacArthur said earlier, increasing access to research outputs. This allows for democratisation of knowledge through open access to journals and to data, which allows citizens and patients and indeed governments to be able to read and understand far more of the knowledge that's going on within academia. However, there are some problems still. We don't have open access or even free access to a lot of the research that has taken place or funded by government departments. And I would love to see this kind of change and shift a little bit. Secondly, licensing models is not the same as readability or understanding. Just making things CC BY, so making things openly available for all to read, is not the same as allowing somebody, a general member of the public, who hasn't been scientifically trained, to necessarily understand what's being read. So we need to find ways to really change that. And finally, there's a growth in an ability to do science. And this is something that I really love and I think is absolutely amazing. So we've seen a rise in citizen science over the last, 10 years again, thanks to the internet largely. We see all sorts of projects. I chose the bee watch because I thought the bee looked cute. But you can kind of go out and spot any animal or even meteorites that you want and log where you saw it online. And this kind of really democratizes the process of science because you remove it from the institutions far more. And there is, however, a problem. Is citizen science really science? It's often, as far as I can see, the process of creating data monkeys, finding people, a general population, and outsourcing tasks that an institution or a bunch of academics haven't been able to convince a PhD student to do. The power rests with the academics and not with the citizens, and I'd really like to see that shift in some ways. So, just to summarise, I think we are seeing a democratisation of science. I think we are seeing more people in a wider space able to get involved in the scientific process, but I think we still have a lot more that we need to do. I think we need to have more meaningful conversations and dialogues about what science. I think that we need to find ways to have more citizen involvement in funding decisions. And I think that the conversation around what transparency around funding and research in universities is something that I'd really like to see started. As I said, publishing more open access, or at least free access, to government-funded work, government-department-funded work, would be good. And as would building on projects such as ScienceGIST, which start looking at how to find and not make knowledge more accessible to non-expert audiences. And then finally, I'd really like people to question power structures in citizen science projects more. I think that's something that's really, really important. Because until we actually have normal citizens being involved in the process of designing research experiments and going all the way through from hypothesis forming through to publishing, be that even as a blog post online, then I don't think we can really say that they're doing citizen science. And finally, or absolutely finally, although we do have this increased democratisation, I think that it's really important to have this conversation about the role of industry, because industry is privatising the scientific process. And I think that given that they're non-accountable in the many ways that they aren't, because they are private companies, we need to be thinking about what role we want for industry and how comfortable we are with that. Thank you.
So, hands up for questions now.
Right,
next up we've got Erg, who's going to be talking about science and art.
Hello.
try to not electrocute ourselves while we do this. Is this working or not? So, basically, I'm Leia Borromeo, and this is Jamie Pereira, and we're kind of one half of a collective known as Disobedient Films. My background is as a journalist and as a live artist and a filmmaker, and Jamie is a composer, mostly for films and for other sort of sound experimenting.
Yep, sound experiment stuff. I also do audio branding, which is the science of sound applied to businesses, which is a bit insidious, but I'm also starting to look at sound within healthcare environments, which is good.
Yeah. So Disobedient started out as a company off the back of the V&A's Disobedient Objects exhibition. And we were, myself and Catherine Rao were asked to make a couple of films, and we ended up making one film that reappropriated the internet pop-up as a narrative device. So something that was previously used for porn was then used for documentary. And that was featured at this year's Sheffield Documentary Festival, and has gone down pretty, I think, kind of well. This project we're currently trying to get launched on here is something called Climate Symphony. And this started out at a Hack Day run by the Center for Investigative Journalism, where we were asked to reframe climate change. And I came up with this idea of essentially wrapping sensors around trees and then taking the data from that and then sonifying it. And it became something that we ended up developing as a sort of, I don't know, as an idea to actually turn it into a documentary, into an hour-long television special, and would like to sort of take it as a means of actually, what are we doing? Taking data from, oh shit, where is this piece of thing? I was actually going to, I've got a longer form for this. So, basically, last month the White House released 150 data sets on climate change, covering topics from energy to architecture, from tech to transport. So this means we have a framework through which we can identify key stories at the heart of climate change. And so much of the conversation around climate change is bleak, and we would like sort of climate symphony, and the way we would do it would be to take all that data, find characters that fit that data, record their stories, and
slideshow's not working,
that's
no.
Fine. Okay, so record their stories, and then also assign musical instruments like Peter and the Wolf to those characters, and then from that have music that plays, and this is where we would play the music, and it would go dum 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 dum. Do we have a stick? We have a stick. I have my stick. Ah.
It did work when we swapped over the leads, so we can try that. Does mean that I need to boot up again.
Okay.
Which is a bit crap.
It just makes it more immersive. That's good.
Yeah. This is a little bit, yeah. It also kind of like proves how utterly dependent we all are on things that go blip and blop. And this is actually the technical term. It's things that go blip and blop. How many people in here are dependent on things that go blip and blop? Yeah, you see, and do you make things that go blip and blop?
Hold on, you're plugged into the wrong one.
Yeah. So could you stick the other end of that into there, please?
That sounds phenomenally sexual.
Yeah, it does to you, Lair.
It sounds overly sexual. Things about sticking things into other things. And not fitting.
It fits.
This is now about science and innuendo. Sorry, hashtag distractingly sexy. Come on, Jamie.
Come on.
We had a whole thing kind of orchestrated, and then suddenly this
will do.
The blip and the blop just no longer works. But, yeah, I mean, this is this something that you think is a little bit kind of slightly mental? Have you heard of anybody who's actually tried to take kind of data sets, find stories out of them, and then assign, like, sort of Peter and the Wolf and Klinghoffer musical instruments to them, and from that, then compose a four-part symphony? Is that something that, I don't know?
Or has anyone heard of anything like that happening?
Yeah?
Instruments is certainly something I heard on the click radio on the Frequency World Service. That was, I think it was that they were trying to put themes into a piece of music based on some environmental input.
Oh, yeah, actually, one of the guys who worked nice here, Ian Forrester.
Oh, right.
He wasn't in that. He's not in the room, but he's in the building. He's here.
Oh, great. What's his handle? Want to twat
Cubic
at him.
Garden.
Sorry?
Cubic Garden.
Cubic Garden.
Yes. Or just type in Forrester.
Yeah. But, yeah, because I might want to twit and twat at him.
We're
that,
in.
Because,
almost there.
I've heard of some people doing stuff around privacy and website tracking and trying to create, link that up to instruments and some kind of sonic synthesizer. And I would have to go away and Google a few things to actually come up with the correct terms to provide you with some information on that.
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting in terms of bringing home to people about how kind of websites can kind of actually track you and follow you across different spaces.
This is great because this whole sort of like this whole space of data sonification is something that really makes my knickers go fizzy. And the actual sort of hack thing started when I was having a chat with Jack Searle from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, and he was talking about his study and his work on drones. And then I explained to him that there's a whole team of people, or like kind of a genre of people who do things like not just John Cale style drone music, but actually taking the sounds of drones and turning that into song, as it were. And he's just like, this is a thing? I said, this is definitely a thing. And so this is how it kind of came to what I think Jamie's going to explain a bit.
Yeah, I'm going to explain it a bit quicker. Okay, so this is what I did. This is a sequencer, very normal. It's not Maximus P, which I think I need to learn soon, but Logic, I needed a timeline within which to work, and so I went from 1994 to 2014, and so then went looking around for bits of data. Now, we did scrabble a bit, and we found some examples of data being represented as music, and they all sounded, you know, not brilliant, so I wasn't expecting too much out of this. So the first data set was the decline of Arctic ice, because I'm working within 20 years. I took that bit. It's that bit in the sequencer there, and it sounds like this. That's the MIDI. Suitably depressing cello. A little bit of that. The next one was the rise of CO2 in our atmosphere over, 2007 to 2015. That was really easy because it's just a one line, and so that was represented by noise, speckly noise, which gets a bit more speckly and dense as we go along. Next thing, this was fun. This is you know, the people who have been drowning in the Mediterranean lately. This is looking at their Mediterranean routes from 2000 to 2011. I think when it gets to 2014-15, it just goes off the scale, as we've been seeing in the news lately. But I needed something, and this is where it's good to highlight the instrumentation that was being chosen had to work with the way the data, you know, represented itself. So I needed an instrument that, when played over itself, would sound all right. So I chose gamelan. That's how it was represented on the MIDI sequencer. And this is, it does change. So you see it going there, adding those two. This is all faithfully represented data, etc. And the last one was floods in Pakistan, which are, it's a bit hard to see, but you've got an event in 2003 and in 2007. Massive one in 2010. All of that pertained to sort of a, felt like a percussive strike, you know. So I tried that, and it was again good to represent it like that because the dynamic of the percussion could represent the severity of the flood, and that is the point on the sequencer, and this is what it sounds like. So Anyone want to hear what it all sounded like together? And this is with the expectation that it wouldn't sound
crap.
We were expecting it to sound quite crap. Hopefully it sounds less crap. There's the migrants starting. That's the first flood in 2003 in Pakistan. Every bar is a year going by in this this cello is gradually getting lower as the Arctic ice diminishes. Huge flood in Pakistan. Another huge flood the year after. And the migration level is going up as you can hear the bell sounds going higher and higher. So that was it. And it doesn't sound bad, which we're very pleased about.
There we are. So data sonification
works.
It actually works, and it's not a graph, it's not a pie chart, and it's not, you know, it's not something very PowerPoint friendly, as we've discovered. But we can find ways of displaying it in other ways. Any questions?